On behalf of the Clark Forum, the United States Army War College, and the Philosophy Department, I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's event, The Media as Junkyard Dog, One Journalist's Journey from Secret CIA Prisons to the Walter Reed Scandal. The omnipresence of the media in the contemporary world is a direct result of advancements in information technology, including the internet and the nonstop 24/7 news networks that many Americans have become accustomed to. The public is constantly bombarded with reports about events all over the world, yet we don't always have the tools to make sense of it all. The overdose of information makes it difficult to discern what is true and what is being said for entertainment purposes. The challenge for journalists is to obtain accurate information and be able to report it. But the media and the government sometimes have different ideas about which truths the public has the right to know. As Winston Churchill said during the Second World War, in wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. Now, over 60 years later, as the United States is engaged in another war, the debate about the media's access to information still continues. Dana Priest has written for the Washington Post for over 20 years, covering the intelligence community and national security issues. She was a Pentagon correspondent for 8 years and has traveled extensively with the Army Special Forces and Army Infantry units. In 2001, Ms. Priest was awarded a MacArthur Foundation Research and Writing Grant and was a guest scholar in residence at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Ms. Priest's 2003 book, The Mission, Waging War and Keeping Peace with America's Military, won the New York Public Library Berenstain Book Award. In 2006, she won the Pulitzer Prize for Beat Reporting for her articles on CIA secret prisons and counterterrorism operations. Most recently, in February 2007, Ms. Priest and a colleague exposed the outpatient care scandal at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Ms. Priest holds a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California at Santa Cruz. At this time, I would like you to disable all electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the end of the program, where there will be a question and answer session. Because this program is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. And now, please join me in welcoming Dana Priest.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Margaret, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I know, because I'm a good reporter, that I'm actually competing with a lot of the sports teams, and so if any of you feel like you need to go stretch, there's some room in the back there. I have to make a confession first because I'm at a university, which is that even though I've been a journalist now for over 20 years, I have yet to take a journalism class. I certainly didn't major in journalism. And when I was in graduate school, and if there are any parents here, please cover your ears. When I was in graduate school at Columbia doing a master's, supposedly, in international relations, between the first and second year, I got my internship with the Washington Post on the foreign desk, which was really what I was interested in, and I dropped out of school because I thought, when I finally got to the Post, I'd died and gone to heaven, and this was where I wanted to be. So I'm telling you that story not so that you drop out of school, but so that you know that there are a whole lot of ways to get into journalism. In fact, there are a whole lot of ways to get into whatever career you're thinking about now. I wanted to talk to you first a little bit about, the Junkyard Dog moniker is my own, and it might be too much inside baseball because that's what we call in the newsroom people who don't, who are persistent, is how you would say it in a polite way, who don't give up on things and information that they want to get, even though there are a lot of obstacles in their way. I may have started out that way, but really in the beginning of my career, I think the things that I most remember is not the investigations, but the going and doing things that otherwise I never would have gotten to see things like covering a coal miner strike and going down to the hundreds of feet below the coal mine, and then coming up to talk with coal miners who were struggling with black lung. Or I did a series on jail overcrowding in the Arlington County jails, and I hung out literally embedded with dozens of female inmates who were in this tiny little space. It was a period of time where you were allowed to smoke, so they were all smoking. And despite these terrible conditions, and I wore a prison uniform, they all knew who I was, but within 2 hours, you know, I looked exactly like they did, unrecognizable in the mirror. And despite these terrible conditions, one of the women in the facility was figuring out a way to make makeup, eye makeup, out of chlorine and soap and color her hair so that she could look her best just in case she got a glimpse of the male inmates as they passed through a corridor, and they all used to line up in this little crack and look at each other. And to me, I mean, why do I remember that after all these years? It's because of the human spirit. You know, no matter where you put people, the human spirit of, you know, vitality and seeps through and stands out. Eventually, I got the beat to cover the military. And there, my whole world expanded much, much more greatly. You know, and I have been all over the world with many different levels of the military, with infantry troops trying to do peacekeeping in Kosovo and Bosnia. And I've traveled with the 4-star regional commanders, one of whom you have as your lecturer professor this year, Admiral Dennis Blair, took me on his plane all the way to Indonesia and then on a tinier plane to the island of East Timor. And really allowed me to see his world, as did the other three other regional commanders who at the time had enormous amount of power and responsibility to do all sorts of things that were not military. I also got to travel with Special Forces troops who are all male troops, kind of type A. Never had a reporter embedded with them. This was before 9/11, and much less a female reporter. And a lot of people ask me, well, did you ever get treated differently as a woman? And I really had always a hard time answering that question because I couldn't think of any examples. But luckily, the Special Forces gave me a couple examples. One time, a unit in Nigeria, hearing that I was going to come, decided to paint their bathrooms pink, or one of their bathrooms pink, in my honor. And this was not only to actually welcome me here, but it was also to let everybody else know that don't go near that rest, that bathroom, that latrine. That's the woman's latrine. And the same group printed up signs so that when I went into the, they had a shower where there were three stalls all open together, which was no problem if you were one of them, but being that I wasn't, they made up two signs for me that said female, and I could hang them on either side of the stalls to keep everybody out while I was there. So that is the sum total almost of why it might have been different that I was a female. Other than that, it really wasn't. After I covered the military, I wrote a book called The Mission. And then I decided I really needed to go do something else because I was getting a little bit too close to the subject. And that's an odd thing to describe, and it was an odd thing to feel, but I do believe that journalists need to stay arm's length from the institutions and ultimately even the people that they cover, so that even though they get close enough to people to understand the complexity of the situations that they're dealing with and the grayness of most every decision they're making, at a certain point, if they feel too comfortable, and this is a problem in Washington, I think, they need to change. So I decided, foolishly perhaps, that I'd do the thing that's closest to the military, which was to go cover the CIA. And I couldn't have been more wrong in my assessment. Yes, they both work in the national security arena, but their cultures are completely different. Their access to the media is completely different. And my dreams of being embedded with a CIA team in Iraq, which I tried to use my junkyard dog mentality to pursue, and ended up mainly, you know, beating my head against the wall for a year before I realized I was not going to get to go anywhere with the CIA, and maybe I was never even going to meet somebody in the CIA. The title of the talk is Secret Prisons to Walter Reed, and I chose that because it really bookends to lessons that I've learned in this adventure of trying to write what I consider to be the highest form of journalism, which is investigative reporting. So I wanted to take you on that journey a little bit with me, and to talk first about the Walter Reed stories. Like many good stories in Washington, this one began in a strip club. My reporting partner, Ann Hall, and I had been told by our initial sources that there is a person at Walter Reed who was fleecing wounded, brain-injured soldiers, and he would take them to the strip club that was not far from the post and make them sign fictitious credit card bills, and he would pocket their money. So before we went there, first of all, we were surprised there was such a place within 3 blocks of the Washington Post, but before we went there, we did a little preparatory intelligence work, and we found a reporter at the Washington Post who'd been there recently, and we asked about the seating arrangements, you know, how are we going to fit in, what's it like? He said, you know what, for one thing, don't worry about it. There is no nudity, it's very tame, I don't know why they call it a strip club, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. So we took my husband and borrowed my researcher's husband for cover, and we went to this club, and within 3 minutes of sitting down, there were 4 naked women dancing on the dance pole, and we looked at each other and said, well, we got that one wrong. But worse yet, there weren't any soldiers there. And so we spent 2 hours trying to move around the place in the dark, looking for short haircuts, dipping into the bathroom to interview the strippers during the acts, asking, do you know about those guys from Walter Reed? You know, we're here to meet them. You got any idea who they are? And we had no luck whatsoever. Nothing, nothing. So luckily, we weren't deterred from our first completely utter failure to find this story. And within a couple days or a week, as we kept at it, and kept increasing our network of people telling us little things about Walter Reed, I managed to arrange to get a meeting inside the gates of Walter Reed with somebody who was going to meet with us below the radar. And we were going to go in without letting the authorities at Walter Reed know that we were going to be there. So having not been familiar with the post, you know, I asked this person for very detailed instructions because I didn't want to get it wrong and I didn't want to get caught. I knew that if I did, the whole story would be gone before it really started. So I got the instructions, and the day before, I memorized these instructions, and next morning, went over them again and headed in. And nothing was like I had memorized. And I had to stop 3 times to ask directions to the hospital, which is this giant 4-story building in the middle of the post, and I couldn't even find that. And as I was getting more nervous, trying to stay calm, I finally found it. And drove in and eventually had my interview. And then only then did I realize that there were 2 entrances at Walter Reed, and I had taken the complete opposite one from the one she'd given the directions to me about. So obviously things don't work like a well-oiled machine when you're taking on these investigations. There's a lot of trial and error, and hopefully the error doesn't undo you completely. Obviously things worked out in the end, and we spent 4 months in and around Walter Reed, under the radar of authorities, talking with soldiers and their families and the staffs. And what we discovered was really an inexcusable injustice. It was a system that was failing hundreds of soldiers and their families, and once they had been released from the hospital and were living as outpatients on the grounds of Walter Reed or in nearby hotels. The overflow of this outpatient group, which is numbering in about 700 at that time, 50 in the hospital, 700 as outpatients around the grounds. The overflow that didn't fit into the buildings on Walter Reed and were housed in a dilapidated former lodge, which didn't even have a name. It just had a number, Building 18. And there, many psychiatric patients shared their rooms with mold and cockroaches and mice, and in the winter, the snow and the rain that came in through some of the cracks in the ceiling. One of the lessons that I learned from this story is the importance of blending in, of being a fly on the wall, which is completely the opposite of the image you get of Washington reporters who are shouting some rude thing to the president or the spokesman every day at the briefings. My preferred method is to be the fly on the wall. And you can get so much more from your sources of all types if you can fit in, and that's how I usually approach things. When I covered the military, for example, I wore basically a uniform, navy blue pants, navy blue jackets, navy blue shoes, trying hard to respect the culture, not make a splash, and just to fit in. Well, this worked so well that during my trip to Indonesia, and I don't think Admiral Blair has heard this story before, the Australian defense attaché was introduced to me by the Australian ambassador. And we arranged for a meeting in his office, and he brought me into his office at the embassy, closed the door, locked the triple locks on the steel door, and announced to me, "I know who you really are." And he proceeded, before I could set him straight, and actually before I could figure out what he was talking about, to unroll some very classified maps of the military-backed militias in East Timor before independence, and who was controlling who, and how it all worked down to, or up to, Jakarta. Well, I got pretty nervous when I realized what he was showing me. And I stayed long enough to get a good sense of how things operated and to memorize a couple details. And then I found a way to end the conversation. But I called him up the next day as I was about to leave to remind him that I had been introduced to him as a Washington Post reporter, and that is what I really was. "Oh, shit," is what he said as he signed off on the telephone. I still have his card. I've tried to call him again. lots of interesting things happen inside courtrooms and government briefings and within the troves of records that you can find in any bureaucracy, but nothing is as great as just hitting the pavement. So I also wanted to talk to you about, in a larger sense, another passion that I have, which is national security reporting and post-9/11 in particular, the CIA's counterterrorism operations, and reporting in general in an era of secrecy. Well, my journey into the dark side, as I like to call it now, began with a simple question, which is this: if the U.S. is waging a war on terror, are we succeeding? How are we fighting this war? To figure out, are you succeeding, you need to know, how are we fighting this war? What are its weapons? What are the tactics? What are the strategy? And can we assess whether those tactics and that strategy is leading us to victory or not? And then you can't answer these basic questions unless you figure out what the military and the intelligence world is up to. And I contend that you can't know that unless journalists look at it, because no one in the government is going to delve into it in a way that is going to be meaningful for public discussion. So this is what I found digging into it on my own. On September 11th, the CIA didn't have interrogators. It didn't have prisoners. It didn't have interrogation techniques. It didn't have a mindset or an inclination to have any of this. And on September 12th, President Bush ordered the agency, through a secret presidential finding, to find and destroy the network of al-Qaeda terrorists that were responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Almost overnight, the balance of power within the CIA shifted from its regional divisions, where language and culture and history mattered a whole lot to those division directors, shifted from them to the Counterterrorism Center, which really was a stepchild within the CIA until 9/11. The CIA, the CTC, as they called it, was actually a sort of a backwater. And now it was the center of the universe, and the universe was in panic. And to make a long story short, the president gave the CIA director, George Tenet at the time, and then Tenet gave to the CTC, the Counterterrorism Center, the authority to hunt down and kill or capture top al-Qaeda operatives on a list of high-value targets, HVT. And they could capture them. If they could capture them, all the better, because then they were given special authority to use what we now know is called enhanced interrogation techniques to get information. And under Tenet, the CIA also deepened its relationships around the world with foreign intelligence services. It funded dozens of counterterrorist intelligence centers where CIA officers work side by side, work exists now, work side by side with their foreign counterparts to capture suspects. This covert action program, really it is the largest covert action program since probably the height of the Cold War, has been largely responsible for capturing or killing about 75% of the al-Qaeda network that perpetrated 9/11. That's the good news. It was also responsible for disappearing people, some of them innocents, for abusing people, for skirting international law, and as the Supreme Court is trying to decide now, perhaps U.S. law. In fact, about 18 months after 9/11, some people at the CIA started asking, who were seeing all this, who were read into these programs, you know, what is the end game here? Some worried that the CIA would be left holding the bag when the dust settled and the public regained their calm, and thought more sincerely about what their government was doing in their name. And others thought that the CIA had gone off the rails completely and was conducting itself illegally and would someday be found guilty of war crimes, along with the leaders who approved these actions. Some of these people began eventually to share their doubts and worries about their institution, an institution that they cared an awful lot about, began to share these doubts with me and other journalists. And by pulling the string for 3 years, I was trying to describe this to someone before, it's like not just getting a jigsaw puzzle and putting the pieces together, but each piece of the puzzle is cut up into 5 pieces so that you can't tell anything about what you're seeing until you start assembling the pieces. And 3 years after doing that, I think we now have a pretty good idea about how counterterrorism operations were conducted. From the many important alliances that were built around the world to the secret prisons in Eastern Europe and the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques used on HVTs, legalized in a now defunct legal opinion by the White House Office of Legal Counsel that defined torture only as measures that resulted in death, organ failure, or permanent physical and psychological damage. Not everyone was happy with our reporting on these subjects. President Bush and his national security team called our editors into the White House to stop the publication of parts of the secret prison story. Myself and my editors were, after we published this story, called traitors and unpatriotic in certain conservative pundit circles that had a big microphone on the airwaves. And Congress and its leaders were largely silent, except for a call for an investigation, not of the prisons or the interrogation techniques, but of the reporter and the paper that published them. On the record, CIA officials, after these stories came out, warned of the great damage to national security, of the allies who would drop out from the war on terror. But off the record, or in private, they told us quite the opposite, that although there had been some rough spots, and some countries had decided not to participate in these extrajudicial prisons, the alliances were strong and steady. Al-Qaeda, after all, remains the common enemy, in Europe in particular. Now, what I've just told you about the CIA and all of these things that now we take for granted as part of what we know about what our government did, all of these things were encased in a large barricade of secrecy. And all of them were actually exposed by the media. The secret world has grown larger and larger since 9/11. In fact, in Washington, you aren't worth much at all if you don't have a top secret security clearance in this new secret world. Thousands of new intelligence analysts are working for hundreds of new intelligence solutions companies that do all sorts of things, everything under the sun. Pretty soon, I think you're going to need a security clearance even to drive on the Beltway, much less work in it. The overclassification problem has reached sort of absurd levels, and I have a great example. About 5 years ago, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, something I don't actually do much because I don't have much luck in it. About 5 years ago, I did file one with the Central Command based in Tampa about something I was working on. And last month, a clerk from the Central Command called me up to ask if I were still interested in that information because it had finally been released. So I said, of course, and I got kind of excited about it, and I foolishly let myself believe that I was about to receive a treasure trove that would, you know, change the way we knew about something. Instead, I got a 2-page photocopy of an article that I had written on the subject. And that was it. I'm not kidding. If a newspaper like the Washington Post believes that it's our responsibility to describe the broader contours of the war on terror to help you, the public, judge whether the tactics of this war are effective in achieving our goals, then the newspaper automatically moves into this awful, classified, secret realm. It's really unavoidable. Well, how can that be that on the one hand, the government has structures and rules and punishments in place to keep its secrets, certain secrets from the public, and on the other hand, the media is actively trying to find out these secrets and put them in the newspaper? Well, the answer is the Constitution. First, the Constitution has no prohibition against the media publishing secret classified information per se. There are categories of information that are illegal to put in the paper, like certain signals intelligence and nuclear codes and the names of covert operatives in certain circumstances. But there's no broad law that makes it a crime to publish this material. Now, why is that? Well, the framers of the Constitution didn't basically trust the government. But they didn't entirely trust the press either. So they set up a contest between the two. And you know, most of the protections in the Bill of Rights are protections of individual rights. But the Free Press Clause protects an institution, the publishing business. And it's really the only institution that the Constitution protects. In the famous Pentagon Papers case, Justice Potter Stewart described the contest that the framers established this way. He said, "So far as the Constitution goes, the autonomous press may publish what it knows, and it may seek to learn what it can. But this autonomy cuts both ways. The press is free to do battle against secrecy in government, but the press cannot expect from the Constitution any guarantee that it will succeed. The Constitution, in other words, establishes the contest, but not its resolution. Congress may provide a resolution through carefully drawn legislation, but for the rest, we must rely, as so often in our system we must, on the tug and pull of the political forces in American society." That's Justice Stewart. "Our responsibility, the media's responsibility, is to play our role in that contest. For as he said, for it is the contest itself that serves the public interest. So if we fail at this, we fail the media to meet our responsibility. We fail to live up to the enormous and special protection that was given to us under the Constitution. And we are all the worse for it. Just consider what happened before the war in Iraq when the media did not push hard enough to figure out whether the administration's assessment of WMD in Iraq was correct. All of that information was classified. We had to use the same methods that we used in more controversial stories. And many people have taken the media at task for not doing a better job. I think that secrecy gets in the way of good government. It gets in the way of important debate, of public debate, but also of private debate within the government. I think that secrecy is one of the big reasons that 9/11 happened. The CIA was hoarding information under its secret compartments, and the FBI was hoarding information under its secret compartments, so nobody was sharing it with the public. I can remember when I traveled with the four regional commanders throughout the world, many of them allowed me to see sensitive information, most of which did not fit into any story I was writing. And I have to say, disappointedly, most of it was not revelatory. It was a version of what you could see in the open source. But the one thing that I wasn't allowed to be near was a corner of an office in the Central Command that dealt with terrorism. This was before 9/11, and I didn't really even know, you know, what it was that was so secret or why. And when you think back on why the American public was surprised at 9/11, in part it was because we had never heard of Al-Qaeda before, and most of us had not heard of Osama bin Laden. One of the only assignments that I turned down from editors before 9/11 was when they asked me to go create a terrorism beat. And I said, well, I'm a little suspicious, you know, I think that we would be just hearing more about the threat if it really existed. But I'll go do due diligence. Defense Secretary Cohen at the time, when he made speeches, he would say this is one of the biggest threats to the country, but he wouldn't put any details on it. So I spent about 2 weeks talking with my sources at the Pentagon, who were sources of various levels and often, you know, pretty straight with me. Had the Pentagon really reorganized in the way that Secretary Cohen was suggesting? And after 2 weeks, I came away with a lot of shrugs. I don't think so. Not that I've heard. Things like that. This is a reporter who's taken 2 weeks full time to figure out whether the U.S. government is really reorganizing itself to meet what it says is a giant threat. And the Pentagon isn't doing it. So I, mistakenly, figured that this was an overblown threat. Having looked back on that subject many times after 9/11 and thinking, how did I miss that? I really do think that the culture of secrecy, the overclassification, and the hoarding of information by different government bureaucracies allowed us all to let down our guard and to think that, and to not even know that this threat was out there the way that it was. The other reason that secrecy is not efficient is that secrets are hard to keep these days. I'll give you one example. We all know now, in fact, there's a movie coming out called Rendition, and we all know now about the Rendition flights that carried terrorist suspects who were picked up in one country to another country and done all in secret. We don't really know exactly how many people were moved around the world. We know that the CIA had some front companies that it created to do this and a fleet of aircraft that it had seconded or contracted out to do it. But at the time, when this was beginning, we didn't have a clue about any of this. It was all secret. Well, in 2002, the Post wrote one of the first stories about this. We still didn't know what it was, but we knew that there was a guy on a tarmac in Jakarta, I think it was, that was whisked away in the middle of the night, and about a half an hour, well, and the Dawn newspaper of Pakistan, because he was Pakistani, had written a tiny story about this in the Dawn newspaper of Pakistan, not something that we all read, and had published the tail number of a plane that was parked suspiciously at an Indonesian airport and thought to be carrying a Pakistani with links to Al-Qaeda. Well, within a half an hour of that publication, and the Dawn is now on the internet was abuzz. Bloggers on a conservative website in the United States connected the tail number of that airplane to a company in Boston called Premier Executive Transport Service. You can connect these things now pretty easily. FAA has its records on the internet. On the blog, one blogger wrote, "Sure sounds like Air America thing to me." Air America was the secret transport logistics air cargo thing set up during the Vietnam War. "Sure sounds like an Air America thing to me," one of them wrote. Well, with a little legwork and going up to the Massachusetts Corporation records, which I did one afternoon, I got a list of all the officers of the Premier Executive Transport Service. And with a little more work, we put all their names into our database. And my crack researcher, who now had a dozen names, started doing her thing, Julie Tate. And within a couple days, she came over to me, and she was very worried. She said, "This is really weird. None of these people exist." I said, "What do you mean none of them exist?" She said, "Well, I can find all the places that you've lived with your social security number or your name. And none of these people had lived anywhere, ever, except they all had a P.O. box. Not the same one. They all had different P.O. boxes." Well, with a little more work, we discovered we could look into the P.O. boxes electronically and get all the names of all the people who were signed up at five P.O. boxes, all linked together somehow, within the Northern Virginia area. And with a little more work, we had passed the names of 257 people through our computers and learned that none of them ever lived anywhere before. And although they were in their 40s and 50s, they had all gotten their social security numbers around 2002. So we took this information, we drew it up into a schema, a chart, flow chart sort of thing, and we took it to the agency. Well, actually, I tried to take it to the agency, but they still wouldn't see me. I said, "I've got this chart. I think I'm seeing this thing. We're probably going to write about this. Maybe we should talk about it." And they said, "Can you fax it over?" I said, "I really think you need to talk with me about it. Can you fax it over?" So I faxed it over, and 2 days later, I got the word back from the agency. No comment. So what do you mean no comment? We're going to put this in the paper because I believe, and it wasn't just this information, it was also people who knew more who were helping me confirm that this was actually what it was. We could put in the newspaper that the CIA had created a number of front companies in order to create the logistics support system that they needed to fly terrorist suspects secretly around the world. So the point there, and it's a point that I'll end on, because I know hopefully you'll ask some questions, is that for all the reasons that secrecy is not a good thing in an open government, one of them is that it's very hard to keep a secret these days. And it's bad government, I believe. Obviously, there are a lot of nuances here, and there are a lot of things that we did not publish in the newspaper. Well, that may not be obvious, but I'll tell you that. And so hopefully, if you have any questions about that in our process for figuring that out, I would be happy to answer them, or anything else. I would like this time to be the turning of the tables. The media always gets to ask hard questions. And I just told that to 300 Army officers at the War College. I said, now's your chance. And boy, did they let me have it. So I make the same offer to you. Thank you very much, and welcome your questions. And we have microphones coming around.
Is this working? All right. How did you get access to, like, databases and information where you could look up where people have lived over the years and all stuff like that?
Well, it's actually commercially available. So the Post just bought it. Like, it's not cheap. And then you have to know how to use it. And you have to have certain basic information about people. The funny thing, or not so funny if you're in the agency, was that the names that they gave people were really bizarre. I mean, they weren't John Smith. It wasn't something that there might be 100,000 of them out there. They were really odd, quirky names, which I'd love to figure out. Why did they do that? So they weren't actually that hard to trace. But it is commercially available. And one of the things that it may have happened in the agency, but I'm not sure because they wouldn't tell me, is if I were them, I would have used this as a lessons learned type thing. Well, how was it that our cover is what they call it, to put something undercover so that we don't find out about it? A lot of things have a reason that everyone would find legitimate. How was it so uneasily unmasked? The answer might be that even the CIA doesn't fully realize how many things can be found out using not even a reporter's special skills, but using technology that's available today. To me, it's kind of like 15 years ago when CNN, 20 years probably now, CNN first came on board, and they were everywhere. Certainly they were in the Balkans during the Bosnia and Kosovo conflicts, and military came up with the term the CNN effect for everything, which was this, to them, a new effect, which is CNN may be somewhere we're going to be before, or they may broadcast it, and it may create a whole ripple effect, which then may boomerang back on us and affect our operations. This is the CNN effect. And we have to, at first they wanted to figure out how to counter it, and then they wanted to figure out how to understand it. And then they wanted to figure out how to use it to their benefit, which I believe was done at the opening night of the Kosovo air war, when the first missile launched hit, on purpose, a fuel depot. Oh, what happens then? Well, first of all, there aren't a lot of civilians around. It was outside Belgrade. Huge explosion. And who captured that explosion? CNN. We, back at the Pentagon, we couldn't even figure out, they wouldn't even tell us how many cruise missiles were launched that night, as if for some reason that would give away some great secret. We couldn't find that out for a month. But somehow CNN knew how to be right there when that explosion was happening and to broadcast it, and it looked terrifying. Well, that was CNN effect now being used by the military to create a ripple effect of what they were doing. It's the same with technology now. And some parts of the government get it, but I'd say most of them don't get it. And they don't get to what extent the enemy, Al-Qaeda, understands the use of technology. My favorite moment in the congressional hearings after 9/11 was when John Pistol, who at the time I believe was the deputy counterterrorism, or he might have been the counterterrorism head at the FBI, in an aside comment said, well, he didn't type. He would go home and write his notes out longhand in his secretary. Well, okay, big deal. So what? He doesn't type. Al-Qaeda not only types, they know how to use the internet in a way that cannot yet be undone or traced back by the people who created the internet, basically the U.S. military. and by all the brains who are willing to go up against al-Qaeda. And if the head of counterterrorism doesn't know how to type, you know, it's like saying I'm trying to live in France and I don't know how to say anything in French. So technology has a little far afield from the question, but technology has allowed us and everybody else to do a certain type of reporting that we couldn't do 10 years ago. And reporters are using it all over for a lot of other different things too. Pattern analysis, looking at contracting documents, all sorts of things.
I have a question that pertains to the Post's official decision to withhold to disclose the locations of such black sites that you mentioned are CIA secret prisons. The organization Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has recently alleged that the possibility that illegal, unpopular government actions might be disrupted is not a consequence to be feared. However, it is the whole point of the U.S. First Amendment. Furthermore, by not disclosing these locations, it would make it impossible to have them closed, and thereby the Post is enabling the rendition, secret detention, and torture of prisoners at these locations to continue. Another consequence might be that U.S. soldiers and civilians are put at risk. The Post's official position had been that these revelations released could open the U.S. government to legal challenges, particularly in foreign courts, and increase the risk of political condemnation at home and abroad.
Well, that was not the Post's. The Post's rationale for not releasing the names is found in the story in which we first exposed the prisons in Eastern Europe. So I'll tell you what it says, because I was involved in a lot of those discussions. It basically says the Post is withholding the names of the countries because the administration has made the assertion, which we found to be credible after talking about it and talking with our other sources, that those particular countries could be subject to special targeting by terrorists, because we're not just talking about anybody in these prisons, we're talking about the Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds of the world. And secondly, that these countries were cooperating with the United States on counterterrorism measures that would not be considered controversial, that actually would be considered very productive within a strict reading of the law. And they might feel compelled to stop that cooperation. So those were the two rationale that swayed the day. What was off the table was political embarrassment, either of this administration or any other country. And Len Downey, who's the executive editor of the paper, he's the one guy who actually made the final decision after lobbying. He got lobbied by the White House, including up to the Vice President and President Bush, who made the case that it would damage national security in a general way, and then in a more specific way when we asked, as we did, well, can you be more specific, mentioned these things. Those two did not mention it, but other people who were speaking for them at a more detailed level did. So I know what some of those other things are, because in the process of reporting about the alliances that were built between the U.S., between the CIA and its foreign counterparts, I learned a lot of different things about a lot of different countries were doing, most of which would be considered a positive news story in that they are productively finding suspects, picking them up, and then, you know, the sort of questionable thing comes in, which is what do you do with them? So because we had a little bit of knowledge about those, that seemed like a pretty good argument. The more black and white issue on the things that we withhold, which we do this all the time when we're dealing with this subject, are things that put troops or U.S. personnel in clear danger. But again, or disrupt an operation before it's happened. But again, the political embarrassment's really off the table. However, we thought, and I thought this was a very good solution, that it was still really important to say Eastern Europe. And why is that? Because Eastern Europe has lived under not the rule of law for so many years as part of the Soviet bloc. And in particular, their intelligence agencies had had a lot of autonomy and were very corrupt in some ways, and were even now competing with each other and competing against the government that wants to be run by the rule of law. So really we're talking about still emerging democracies or immature democracies who are struggling to be mature democracies. And we went in and worked with that element within the country secretly and arranged this. Those prisons are not technically illegal under U.S. law because they derive from a presidential finding. But they are illegal in the countries in which they operated. So that's the explanation. Did you want to follow up on that? You got your hand up. It's certainly hypocritical at the least that on the one hand we talk about human rights and due process and habeas corpus and our tradition of all of that and Geneva Convention, and on the other hand we're asking a segment of this of a country to undertake something that's contrary to all of that. It's interesting to me that one of the, two things. One is that although the issue was met, as I described here, with a lot of condemnation of the post, in Europe it set off a giant inquiry. The two, the European Commission and the European Parliament both started inquiries. The German government started its own. The Swedish government has one going. And virtually every country in Europe had to prove that it hadn't, either it had, which it wouldn't comment on, or it hadn't participated in renditions in secret prisons. So in Europe, it had a huge ripple effect that continues today because the governments involved are, have not, come clean or whatever, talked about this. And I've lost the other point. Okay. Oh, I know what it was. Sorry. The other point was, I'm sorry, that's how my brain works now. The other point is that the first people, this is interesting, if some of you are not aware of, have not hung around the military a lot, that some of the most fierce opponents to the idea of putting people in Guantanamo-like facilities and treating them that way were the Air Force and Navy JAGs, who stood up to the administration when they were first doing this and stood up to the White House legal counsel when they were doing this. They did this first internally, privately. Eventually, they did it publicly with us on background. And eventually, some of them have actually come out with their names attached in a very public way to say what they disagreed with. So the military was really very strong. And I'll never forget, in the barrage of hate mail and really vicious, unbelievable stuff that I got after the secret prison stories ran, I got the most incredible note from a 4-star out in the world who said, I know this has been hard, and I know that some people disagree with what you did, but to me, it's, fundamental American values that are at stake. And because no one can question that 4-star is front and center in the war on terror, yet does not agree with secret prisons and other extrajudicial methods. So the point of the whole thing is to have the debate, which until then we couldn't have because we didn't know much about it. Sorry.
All right.
Try again.
I just had a question about sourcing a little bit. When you are dealing with these sort of secret issues and these sort of secrets you're trying to uncover, I would assume that you encounter a lot of people who want to remain anonymous and who want to remain off the record for obvious reasons. how do you deal with sort of the credibility of those sort of sources, especially when you're put in these situations where you're expected to be held accountable for what you're reporting on? How do you strike that balance?
Well, first, none of them were, or the ones we used in the stories were not off the record. They were just, they were anonymous. They were, I mean, I know who they were, but they didn't want to be in print. They didn't want to have their job title, their agency, anything in print. So I went for about 3 years. If you looked in my clips, there were no names anywhere. There was rarely a job description anywhere. And my editors, you know, we talk about it, but there's no other way to do this particular job. And it really is particular to the CIA and the intelligence world in general, because they're just not supposed to be talking to you. Military, it depends, you know, and much better in that regard. At least you can talk about, you know, the person's position sometimes, or the service they're with, or something. And often you can quote them. So the credibility issue, well, that then lies entirely on my shoulders, because I'm not telling anybody who these sources are, ever. I mean, not even my editors. They can know generally something about the person, but not going to know their name, because first of all, if they know their name, they don't know them anyway, really, necessarily. So that means that it's only over time and working on less hugely impacting stories can you judge the credibility of a source. So nobody, you know, do you have one conversation with and rely on them. And then there are ways, and if you thought about it a lot, you could figure out how to do this, to figure out whether a person has a credibility within, you know, a circle of people. And then, of course, there's the worst method, which is if somebody tells you something and it turns out to be wrong. And then, you know, you're very careful the next time. So as a result, these stories took many, 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 many months to do. And I remember one story that I did about this place called the Salt Pit, which was a jail prison in Afghanistan. And it was a story about one guy who had died, I don't even know his name, of hypothermia there, under the supervision of a young CIA officer who was put there to, you know, help the Afghans interrogate people. He was put there with no experience. It was symptomatic in a way of how the agency was just caught flat-footed, not enough people, and its senior people were actually not going into the field, perhaps as they should have. So I was trying to put it in a context. But that one story took me probably 6 months to put together, and it wasn't even a very long story, but it was, I think, pretty powerful because I could get a certain kind of detail that made it read authentically. And for my credibility and the paper's credibility, I felt like I had to do that since nobody was going to be named in the story in any way. So it's a special problem, which, you know, of course, makes it all the more interesting and fun in a certain way, but it is difficult.
Yeah, you mentioned using the internet and certain new media tools as like tools of investigation and also things like that. But I was just wondering what you thought about. There's concern recently about like the internet and certain non-mainstream news things, non-newspaper sources of news, like diluting the news environment.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, I'm an evangelical for the mainstream media now, and for being the fourth estate, you know, because I really realize the role that we play in times like this. You know, I love Jon Stewart, but Jon Stewart would have no jokes if he didn't read the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, maybe watch a couple networks. And people don't always realize this. You know, they don't realize that the bloggers are blogging on something that they've read somewhere else, but probably it's so diluted by the time it gets to them, they don't even know that actually it was the New York Times that broke the story. One of my favorite stories about this does have to do with the New York Times and Jim Risen, who's one of the two reporters who broke the NSA wiretapping story. And he told this funny story one day about how the blogosphere just lights up after these things happen. And about a week after the New York Times story and all the storm that it created, he was online doing a chat, and one of the questioners wrote in something like, "I don't understand why the mainstream media doesn't pick up the story about NSA wiretaps." I'm sure the guy was dead serious. So it's a very disturbing trend. And what goes along with that trend are equally disturbing facts, which are that more and more the mainstream news, the big news media like myself and the networks, are competing against entertaining news. And so I find that, you know, more often than not, on the front page of the Washington Post is a fun reading feature that, in my opinion, has no place on the front page of the Washington Post. But, so, of course, being the wallflowers that we are, we don't say anything to our editors, And when we say these things to our editors, they say, well, we're competing with a new market, and we don't really know, you know, we're experimenting still. We don't really know what to do and how to do this. And that brings me to the third disturbing trend, which is we are, as an institution, and as an industry, in the middle of enormous change and turmoil. And nobody knows exactly how it's going to end. Fundamentally, the newspapers have not figured out how to make money on the web yet. And the readership is declining, the readership of the newspaper. So we know that the web readership is increasing, and the paper readership is decreasing. But we don't know how to sustain ourselves in several years when it's, you know, even more like that. And it's a frightening place to be for a lot of people, and I'm hoping that, you know, some brilliant business brains will figure this out. Or you're going to see more papers go the way of the LA Times, which is an excellent newspaper, but it's much less excellent than it used to be. And investigative reporting, in particular, is costly. There's great investigative reporting still done around the country at small papers. It's really hard for small papers to support it. The Walter Reed story, I'm probably one of the higher paid national reporters, and so is Anne, because we both have been at the paper a long time. And that story took two reporters working 4 months. So that's almost a year, because you add in the web people and the graphics and all that. And then on top of that, you add the risk, which is that maybe there isn't a story there. Maybe it ends at the strip joint. So investigative reporting is risky to undertake, because not because you might get caught at something, but because the story might not be there, and you basically waste a lot of time and the company's money and, you know, this sort of thing. So it's expensive to do. So I think that you're seeing fewer and fewer outlets actually doing it. How do you change that? Well, I don't know. I'm open to ideas, and so is the paper. But to me, it's really critical that at some point, maybe they'll start talking about, you know, the role of journalism in civics courses, where you learn the three branches of government, and then you learn about the fourth estate, which is a term that always just sent shivers up my spine, because I didn't want to be, you know, any part of government or quasi-government or anything. But I really realized in this period after 9/11 the value of a fourth estate that is built in to the Constitution, built into the competition of ideas and policies and beliefs between the and authorities of the three branches of government that are supposed to compete with each other, and the best man wins. And here we are as the fourth estate sort of shriveling up. And that is not good. So that's my pitch for the Fourth Estate.
Just a question about methods, actually. I'm the online editor for the Dickinsonian, and it's something that we struggle with a lot, and I feel like you're very relevant to. But a lot of times you're on the forefront of the investigation, going with something that's never been published about before. And clearly there are many clear-cut cases where, you know, this is a good story, you go through. But then there's other ones that sort of, I feel, you know, you're less sure about. How do you decide, first of all, whether something is really going to be newsworthy and really worth publishing and pursuing? And second of all, how do you decide sometimes when maybe the blowback from publishing that story might be too great?
Let me take the blowback first. You know, you can't pay attention to blowback. I mean, you have to pay attention to these things that we were talking about, ruining operations and endangering lives. Definitely. Everything after that, you have to be willing to burn your bridges. Now, I never set out to burn bridges. I like the people that I cover. You know, I mean, we're all people who have varying ideas about how the world should be. They're basically all trying to achieve the same thing, but they come at it differently. So, you know, but you have to be willing to burn bridges, willing to have people angry at you, willing to have some blowback. What's the point, you know, if you're not? Because really, again, going back to the basic point here, which is, who's going to do it if the media, if the investigative journalist doesn't do it? And if you don't do it, it doesn't get done. Now, that's not to say that you rush to print with something that's not accurate, because the worst feeling in the world is to have something wrong. I mean, that has happened. And, you know, you want to go throw up. The Jessica Lynch story, that one I participated in, and it was wrong. And, you know, the sources that I dealt with were sources that I had known from a long time, and I think they thought it was right at the time. This was the story about this woman truck driver on the march to Baghdad, got lost and ended up in a big firefight. Well, she didn't really end up in a big firefight. And people, when they learned that it was wrong, they tagged me with all sorts of labels. A certain faction said, well, this is because she has a pro-women in combat agenda. I do. Other people said it was because, I love this one, it was because the administration's war was not going so well, so the Post was a pawn in helping to rally new revitalized spirit. Oh, really? You know, really what it was the sources were wrong. You know, maybe I should have waited longer to get more sources. So, definitely accuracy and fairness are both the things to achieve. And then when do you know a story is not there is a really hard one, because I think you just know it after lots of experience. I mean, there are stories I probably didn't pursue that still resonate in my mind. You know, I know they're there. Can I get them? How long will it take? And is it really what I think it is? Most reporters go into a story not knowing what the story is. And this is something that drives the government crazy. You know, people I was with in the military a lot, they would say, okay, what are you after? Most honest answer was, well, I'm not really sure. You know, I think maybe it's this, but I'm not really sure. That's the honest answer. I mean, there's some exceptions, obviously, covering a press conference or something, you know, pretty straight. But normally, you just think you might know. And then you have to be fair and open-minded enough so that if it shifts, if it's slightly off, or if it's completely the opposite, you have to be able to either discard it and it's not a story, or go with the new thing that you're seeing. And it's something that, if you do it enough, I think gets slightly easier to do. And the other thing is, I tell journalism students this especially, but I think it works for other people. You know, journalists are on the tube talking all the time, you know, now more than ever. They're always yapping about, you know, not only the stories they do, the stories other people do, and they're into opinion and all of this. We've lost the skill of listening, because it can give you so much. People are always telling you things, whether they're telling you directly or indirectly, through body language. You need to develop, as a journalist at least, better listening skills, which often means you need to stop talking and just listen. So.
Yes. it's always interesting to hear a story or read a story in the paper that you know the other that you're involved in as well.
Yeah, I bet.
I spend a lot of time at Walter Reed. I'm very active there. And I want to talk about accurate words, because I've read your articles, and accurate impression, and how different they sometimes are. And does your understanding of responsibility of a reporter or news, they compel you to seek the facts, but do they also compel you, where does your responsibility end as far as what happens to the information that you've put out? I know people, some good people, who lost their jobs at the Walter Reed thing.
Right.
And where does that fit in for you?
Well, Walter Reed is a really great one to talk about that because of all that happened afterwards and all that still needs to happen, not in terms of punishing people, but changing the situation. Really, my role ends with the story and following up if there are other stories. So in terms of characterizing the situation there, we were, I thought, very careful because when it turned out to be even worse situation than we thought, and we were going to have to make some judgment calls on adjectives, you know, or descriptions that we made, we really wanted to be accurate. And we had a little disclaimer in there, which I don't think, you know, is high up in the story, but I, you know, judging from the questions I get, I'm not sure people read it, which is we weren't talking about the hospital. We were talking about the outpatient situation. Very high in the story. I don't know if it got read. And when TV turns it into a 1.5-minute hit, they don't really talk about it. So they don't do the caveats. But I can't be responsible for television, too. You know, it's hard enough being responsible for my little part of the world. I really don't have a responsibility once the story is printed. I'll say that the reaction to it surprised me in that the military does not fire or cache or sack people often. I've written a lot about a lot of military scandals, and people seem to go away into some other corner, but they're not, you know, sacked. And in this case, boom, they were out. Now, why is that? I think there's reasons that don't have to do with me. It has to do with the timing of the article and the fact that perhaps that Donald Rumsfeld wasn't there anymore. Gates has a whole different view of the media. I mean, he actually, you know, said the media is not the enemy at the Naval Academy address. People were willing to go on the record. I think it had a certain shock value because if there's one thing we learned, hopefully, after Vietnam, it's that the last controversial war is that you don't blame the soldiers for the policy that brought them to war. You know, their job is to fight the war. And I think people really felt that they weren't, you know, that we all wanted to support the soldiers and that that's what was happening. So when it turned out not to be true, there were people were just angry as anything. My email, I got thousands of emails, none of it organized. My phone, Phil, I had to empty it every 20 minutes for the first week and a half. One of the things that people wanted to call about is, what can I do to help? I mean, you name it, people were willing to donate it. Time, you know, money, things, everything. And this was, for me, one of the most frustrating things because, okay, this isn't my role as a reporter to figure out how to get these donations organized. But I wanted to tell him something. The problem was that the place, so I called up Walter Reed and said, I'm getting besieged. You know, where would you like me to send these calls? Well, send them, ma'am, to the Army, to the Family Support Center. Well, that center happened to be a third story that we wrote after the first two because the director of that center had set up, unbeknownst to the command at Walter Reed, his own charity in Arizona and was diverting contributions to the Walter Reed, to his own charity, and now, because of the story, he was under criminal investigation. So I didn't have anywhere to send him. And I didn't ever find a good solution, which bothered me a lot. We put up on our web, we put up the names of a dozen organizations that we knew and had used before in our papers during the many stories, the many positive stories that we'd written about Walter Reed up until that time. And so that was sort of the best thing that we do. And, you know, occasionally if the time is right and the two sides come together, I'll link up. You know, there's a pro bono law firm that's trying to organize other pro bono lawyers to help on disability cases. And yes, I will put them together, you know, if I have the time to do that. And I certainly would like to have more time, but it's not what I'm supposed to be doing. So it's not satisfactory. But did you have another? You're shaking your head. I'm not sure if that's... Well, might not be inaccurate for some people, though, because let's take John, Staff Sergeant Shannon, who was prominently featured, the last person who ever thinks of himself as a victim, sniper team leader for 9 years. He didn't grumble to the media when things, you know, went haywire. He took things into his own hands. And then when I found him, and we had many sessions together, and I couldn't believe his personal story, but then the other things he was telling me. At a certain point, I said to him, can I put this on the record? You know, because it was really important. And he looked at me like I still did not get this. And he said, yeah, I'm a sergeant in the U.S. Army. I take care of my men. So for him, the ethical question was not there. He might get in trouble. But for him, the core value was that these guys who he'd do anything for were not getting the service they were supposed to get. So I know what you're saying. I mean, people there don't think of themselves as victims. They think of themselves as survivors. And because of the medical care, are able to survive in amazing ways, climbing, you know, the huge rock walls and running in the Army 10-miler. But the system failed them, and whether, you know, they call themselves victims or we, I don't think we ever used the term, but I understand what you mean by that.
Hello, my name is Eli Brill, and I'd just like to start off by saying thank you for coming and speaking with us today. I found it very insightful.
Thank you.
My question has to do with, obviously, the job of a journalist is to find and then present the truth. Do you feel that, well, I guess my question is, what percent of what actually goes on in the realm of anti-terrorism do we actually, as private citizens, get to hear about? And the second part is, do you feel that the CIA and the State Department has become more or less open since 9/11 about what they do?
Well, I think we, in all, get a very tiny, tiny sliver of what is going on. You know, not all of that is bad, you know, because you can't really write about particular operations without really disrupting the operation. What I try to do, and I think that I did it, although I'm always asking myself, what is going on now? I haven't written anything about the CIA for over a year, is I think we got the broad strokes of the programs that were in place through you know, the alliances with foreign governments, big deal. I mean, really, this is a big deal. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it did capture. It's the most productive thing at capturing suspected al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. And those things were all created after 9/11. Some of them existed, obviously, before, but they were deepened. And money was poured into them and technology and a lot of time. Those are the most productive alliances that there are in the counterterrorism realm. And then, you know, the prisons and the renditions. And again, the CIA didn't have prisoners. Wasn't thinking about this. Neither was the government writ large. What do we do with these people? And I think that in the aftermath of 9/11 and the panic of people that this was going to happen again, a lot of decisions were made that then were not revisited after a while. And maybe you could say that someone like the administration took it as a consensus that this was okay. But I don't think that. I think that they had a set view of executive authority. They were going to push that to the limit during this war, during their counterterrorism operations, during, you know, most everything they do, be it their energy policy committees or what have you. They have a certain view of executive power, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it's a certain particular view that leads to the answer to your second question, which is, are the CIA and the State Department more open? No, they're obviously much, much more closed. And so is the military, a particular part of the military, which is the special operations part. So it's mainly everybody involved in counterterrorism. And, you know, fundamentally, I don't think that's a good thing. Fundamentally, I think that there's this culture of secrecy that's grown up in Washington and in other places where these groups operate that is unhealthy and that cannot almost by its nature be questioned from people inside. I'm not kidding that, you know, the number of security clearances, you cannot work in a large segment of the new burgeoning industrial or intelligence complex that's grown up after 9/11. You cannot work there without a security clearance. And, you know, you really can't get a really good job there unless you have a higher level. Well, that muzzles you immediately. And so I don't know how. And then you add to it, okay, well, we're coming into a presidential election, and nobody's figured out a way to ask the questions that I'm asking. Are we on the right path? They can do it when they lash out towards Iraq. And that's going to be a great debate that we have from now until it ends. But even beyond Iraq, into the other counterterrorism arena, nobody really has figured out a way to talk in a rational, intelligent, probing way about whether we're doing the right thing. And I don't expect that any of the candidates are going to do that. The cost is still too high. They're still going to be on the defensive. And I guess what I mean is the cost too high. It's still too easy to attack them and to get people riled up that they're somehow soft on terrorism. And my concern about that is in the effort to not be declared soft on terrorism, people, policymakers, have lost their critical thinking skills and won't say no to programs that don't make sense. And the bad part about it is, contrary to, say, the buildup during the Cold War, when you could figure out, you know, the $6,000 toilet seat, you know, which was a big expose then about how much money was being wasted in certain programs. Because these programs are so highly guarded, it's just really hard to find them out, bring them to life, and talk about them. And I don't know how that's going to change. I do think it's going to be up to the media to change it. I don't, or not to change it, but to illuminate the problem. So I think we're in for the long haul on the secrecy thing. Thanks. Thank you all.
On behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, I'd like to present you with this plaque as a token of our appreciation. Thank you so much for speaking. This concludes this afternoon's program. Thank you for coming, and have a good evening.